One step into the light, one step away from night. It's the hardest step you're gonna take. The ship to take you there is waiting at the head of the stairs that lead up through your open mind.
Hello, and welcome back to the Rumor Mill News Radio Show, Into the Light, on the Micro Effect Network. This is Dr. Robin Falkov, and our guest today is Charles Osmond, someone who I am very proud to call my friend, someone who is extremely impressive. Charles is a senior fellow at the Institute for Global Futures and serves with the management team of Fourth Venture. He is also chair of the Nanoelectronics and Photonics Forum of NanoSig, senior consultant with Silicon Valley Nano Ventures, and he serves on the scientific advisory board of Legendary Pharmaceuticals. If that's not enough, Charles is also an active participant with the Millennium Project for Global Future Studies and Research of the American Council for the United Nations University. He has authored numerous technical papers and published articles, lectures, which he is frequently around the country and abroad, and he has contributed content that's been featured in a number of books. Charles has also been a featured guest and speaker in a diverse variety of nationally broadcast television and radio programs. He has 25-plus years of experience in the fields of electronics, material science, computing and artificial intelligence, including 8 years at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley and Los Alamos National Laboratories. Welcome, Charles.
Oh, thanks so much. Glad to be here, and welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you. What a pleasure for our audience to hear some of the amazing information that you will be sharing.
Well, hopefully so.
Well, I leave this completely up to you because you are just too widespread and accomplished to try to corral into any one area.
Sort of like a living hologram, perhaps.
Well, yes.
The definition of a hologram, by the way, just in case that sounds confusing, in a technical sense, it means that anywhere within a certain volumetric region of space, you can see the entire image of Earth and it's there.
Ah, okay.
And that actually extends to another area called holographic computing, which may be a little technical, but the idea is that computing is going to shift away from a kind of a linear system where you have address versus data coordinates on a two-dimensional data plane. You're going to go into a much more holographic realm where it's something called content addressable memory, where you can actually touch upon very complex scenarios or contextual things without having to have some kind of a numerical or letter type of designation for it.
Oh, that's fascinating. So how will they go about creating that without the usual language that's used?
Well, this is, I guess we're going to dive into nanotechnology, so here's where we start. Many folks have thought about something called CAM, or content addressable memory, for many years, but the materials didn't exist.
Could you repeat that, please?
I'm sorry, excuse me?
Could you repeat that?
Oh, sure. That's content addressable memory, or CAM for short.
Okay.
And the people who started looking at this idea maybe 25 years ago, one of the real pioneers was a person named Hugo de Garrett, who's quite famous, actually, in the area of what's called evolutionary computing. And evolutionary computing suggests a computing paradigm where instead of everything being hardwired, you've got a CPU and you've got different logic units surrounding the CPU, and then you have the memory and so forth. Throw all that away. What you want to start over and go towards a different direction is something that's completely soft. It's a completely morphable, like an infinite sea of gates, actually. But there's no hard wiring. Everything's sort of like open and in a state of flux. And the way this is done is, in early days, they tried using these silicon chips called FPGAs, which were just that. They're like gate arrays with no essential address on them. But the problem was you needed a lot of them. And Hewlett-Packard built one of these things back in 94 called the Teromax. It was about the size of a small room. Can you imagine this? And, you know, it took zillions of watts to run this thing. I mean, it was a great way to show the concept, but it was completely impractical. However, in the world of nanotechnology, it's not just how small is the thing. That's kind of a misleading way of looking at it. it's really what kinds of material systems can you have access to that you couldn't have access to in other ways. And so this is one of the areas where this really shines, because now we're looking at using proteins and using certain types of phototropic or photoreactive materials and using combined inorganic and organic chemistries to self-assemble or to self-create something that would have the potential capacity for looking like one of these FPGA systems, but at a much higher density with a much lower power cost. So now, here we are in the year of 2009, a lot of folks in the so-called AI world, artificial intelligence, have now been doing this, and they've been creating different kinds of neural net or optical neural net systems that self-create their own interconnects and self-create their own responses to various stimuli, just like the human brain. And you being a doctor, and a wonderful one at that, we've actually had this discussion before about how does the brain work and molecular chemistry and you know, the sort of biophysics of thought, that kind of thing.
Right.
Well, here we are looking at how to replicate that in a package, as opposed to, we're essentially copying what happens in the brain, but putting it into a box instead.
And how close are we?
Pretty close. Closer than some may believe. Now, you know, artificial intelligence is one of those strange worlds where it was kind of misrepresented for a long time. I'm being really careful. I don't want to cast stones in a glass house. But I think in the early days, it was mainly based on writing code that could kind of mimic or look like the behavior of a human being. You know, you could talk to a bot and it would answer with various responses and so forth. But it was a trick. It was just the machine itself was very stupid. It didn't know anything. All it was doing was sort of playing back what it had already been told to do, but in some kind of quasi-randomized fashion. By extreme contrast, there's something called strong AI, which is actually much more like a life form, an actual living thing, where it starts off very dumb, but you can actually allow it to learn on its own from its surroundings. And just like in a human brain, over certain types of exposure, different linkages are established between different neural clusters, or ganglia, as they're called. So in the same kind of idea, can you have this system that will respond on its own to its own interpretation of its surroundings? And the answer is yes. And one of the more interesting examples, there's something called the DARPA Challenge, which that's the Defense Advanced Technologies Initiative. And they had this robotic car contest, where they wanted to say, okay, everybody who wants to participate, try to create a car or a vehicle that can steer itself, autonomously drive through a course, and survive and you know, come back to do another day. Well, the first year this was tried, none of them worked. I think one got like 100 feet or something. But the very next year, more than half the contestants actually completed the course. And this was like a 10-mile course through a desert terrain with all kinds of hills and valleys, and had to cross every stream. It's kind of like New Mexico sort of territory.
Excellent.
And now the next
Charles,
one.
What year was the first?
I think the first one was like 3 years ago.
Okay.
And so I'm trying to show the pace at which this has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I chaired a series ago, or I had chaired a series of conferences. I'm doing something different now. One of the conferences I chaired actually was focused on sort of the intersection of AI and nanotechnology. And one of the folks who showed up was a very young fellow in his mid-20s from a company called Gnome Tech, which is located in New Mexico, in fact, right near where you are.
Mm.
And they were doing one of the first ever sort of applications of a biochemical-based computing platform, which very much used this kind of a process as one of the cognition engines of the car that actually won the race. And so here was an actual physical living thing, not a life form as it would walk around, but certainly a kind of an organic chemistry-based system that was using a lot of the techniques that the brain would use to establish its own sort of criteria of knowledge. And this was about a year and a half ago.
Hmm. Fascinating. I think I'm trying to remember how long ago I first read about using the organic chemistry approach for changing computing, and it's probably been about 15 years ago when I read the first article that we put out there.
Yeah, that's about right. I mean, I think 20 years ago is when my first papers were being published. But it kind of shows you how fast this moves along. And another sort of interesting idea, there's something called DNA computing, which actually uses the 4-bit encoding process that you actually find in DNA for different proteins that fit together in a certain way. So a couple of folks figured out, well, if you have this sort of already embedded 4-bit numbering system in this protein molecule, can we use it as some kind of a computational process? And one of the first areas they wanted to probe into was the ability to crack encryption codes. Now, for obvious reasons, there are some parts that I won't go into, but it's a big deal. And the NSA at one point had their standard level 5, whatever they call it, their 128-bit encryption code that was standard for all the secure documentation and all the various military agencies and so forth. Well, anyway, a group of grad students actually tried this with their DNA computing. It's like, still like a petri dish full of DNA, and there's certain things going on inside the dish that I can't go into. But they cracked the code. The professor who was running the program went off to visit some other university for a couple of months and came back. And when he came back, they had actually cracked the code, and word got back. And in fact, the men in black came in and said, you know, we hear what you're doing. But it didn't arrest anybody, but they actually hired them. that was about 3 or 4 years ago. So I mean, it kind of shows you where these things are going. And I think that at a certain point, the idea of human intelligence and non-human intelligence will be mixed together in an invisible and irreversible way. And one of the things that I've always been talking about for many, many years was this idea of economic systems being so complex and so unwieldy in terms of ordinary humans trying to figure out how to steer or manage the economy, as we're now seeing. I mean, we've seen the results of this. We've seen horrible miscalculations and just blatant crime, really, in terms of selling fake products online and trying to push the evaluation of certain kinds of commodities way beyond their real value and trying to manipulate currency fluctuations so they could trade on the currency. I mean, all this nonsense that I think in an earlier time when things were slower and simpler, you could still use humans to kind of manage or oversee and sort of determine what's going on. We're past that point. I think it's so complex now that no group of human beings can really unravel the sort of strange currents or chaos you find in these economic systems. And I think very shortly you're going to see a commitment to a kind of a non-human way of organizing and protecting the health of whatever economic engines we develop in the future. And I think that's going to be the first edge of where you're going to see this. But at some point, when you walk in your house, the house will know it's you. You'll talk to the house, the house will talk back to you, and all of your appliances and all of your sort of daily life accoutrement will be sort of woven into this sort of invisible but constantly there and a persistent sort of a intelligence envelope that surrounds you. And I think that's going to become the next big thing.
Well, they already have smart houses.
That
integrates so much of what you've just mentioned. The reason I was asking about how long ago, and if you're saying the first articles were 20 years ago.
How about that? Yeah, it might be plus or minus a couple of years. That's roughly that, yeah.
Yeah, I always find that there's such a time lag of about 20 years before you even read about research that's going on. And usually when you first read about it, it means that they're already doing it.
Yes, absolutely. That's correct. I can give you another example. In fact, as you may recall, I was giving a brief talk at the University of New Mexico a few months ago at this Tesla Tech conference. And one of the things I talked about, and you were great when you showed up there, by the way, and one of the things I talked about was this idea of gravity manipulation as a new thing. And it's not really new, but that's what they said. Well, here's the fun part. Boeing Aircraft actually published a couple of articles in their in-house newsletter and said, yes, we've brought up a couple of Russians, and we're looking at some test prototypes and kind of looking at the idea. And then right away, after a couple of articles came out, total silence, no comment, nothing. Now, to me, that says, yeah, well, okay, they're probably working on it. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, I mean, I have seen stuff in the skies that I think probably are the examples of these things being tested. So, I mean, I think it's quite plausible that anytime you see even a hint of some new technology, it's already there, or at least a very serious commitment to be made to develop the protocols and the infrastructure to kind of pursue the next step. That's how I interpret that.
Yes, I agree with you. I tracked down, as a point of interest, an Omni magazine article where I remembered reading in 1979 about computers that monitor all international telephone calls.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And all of a sudden, people are making a big deal about Echelon.
Right, Echelon, so, I remember that, yeah.
To prove my point, I have to go and locate that exact issue.
Well, you know, what's funny is I actually downloaded the Echelon dictionary, as it were, the term index. And this was back when Clinton was in office, and I'm sure you probably know all this stuff. But, I mean, turns out the Brits and the Canadians and the U.S. were the first primary sort of co-developers, and I think Echelon brought in some other folks as well. But this was back in Clinton's time, and one of the key words that this would search for was the name Monica. Now, I just throw it out there as kind of a joke, but it's real. I have it. I've got the dictionary here on my computer somewhere. And they start with a couple million search terms. And so the point is that any time any kind of traffic was intercepted that had a set of keywords or a phrase that might have the words in it, automatically would be raised up to a priority status to be scanned and, you know, different layers of priority beyond that point. But that's been in place for many, many years.
Yes. And that's, you know, to think that it was reported on in 1979.
Yeah.
So you've got to go back 20 or 30 years that it was being worked on and being used.
Yeah, well, this now, I may offer a slightly different take on this. And I'm a person that's been sort of in and out of the quasi-national laboratory, in some cases security-related things, for probably 30-plus years now. The timeline used to be as follows. It would be like a 30-year process. But the first 10 years would be where something is truly at the edge of science, probably being funded for some kind of defense or maybe aerospace application, then it would be hiding in a lab somewhere. Then at a certain threshold, if it got funded from the Congress or whatever, it would then get to the next stage, would be actually deployment. It would actually be sent off to the service in question, maybe an Air Force project or a combined service project, whatever. And then maybe about 10 years after that, it would, some aspect of that would dribble out into the commercial world in terms of some kind of product line or a new manufacturing process or whatever. Now, the timelines have shrunk a little bit, but this is also because the rate of change has dramatically changed itself. We're on an acceleration curve, as I'm sure many folks have talked about. Even Art Bell used to talk about the quickening. Well, the quickening really is happening, and it certainly is taking place in the sciences because it has all these different, what had been very separate or isolated domains of expertise, which are now much more tightly coupled. And so in terms of computing, in terms of material science, in terms of engineering things to a much higher degree of precision than it could in the past, and certainly all different kinds of, even, you know, biology gets into the picture. So the timelines may still be the same approximately, but I think the level of complexity and the level of capacity goes way up. So you can measure it in two different ways. But I don't think it's 30 years anymore. I think it's more like about maybe 10 or 15, and certainly the scale of the things that are being produced is much more than it had been in the past.
Right. I believe Moore's Law states every 18 months.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think Moore's Law is a little bit misleading. I have tremendous respect for Andy Moore, so I'm not going to try to
educate us, please.
but the way I would, in my little 2 cents for it, I would see it more like, instead of how many things can you cram onto the surface of a chip, it's more like how many things in parallel can you process.
Mm-hmm.
I look not in scale of how fast is the device, but rather how much stuff can it do. So I look at a complexity scale as opposed to a size or some kind of regions kind of a comparison. In terms of complexity, I would use biology as my reference point. In other words, maybe 10 years ago, they could mimic the, you know, I don't know, the behavior patterns of an amoeba or something. Now we can mimic the behavior patterns of a rodent. And I think it, before too long, we'll probably be getting close to human level. That's how I would make that comparison myself.
True. Fascinating. What if I can ask that you can speak about and share with us is the most exciting project that you've worked on?
I can't tell you. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, the most of the stuff that I've worked on, and I should point this out, I did have a clearance. I had a Q clearance at one point when I was at Los Alamos, but that was back in the early 80s, and I really haven't done that kind of stuff since then. A lot of stuff I have seen, though, is more to do with private ventures, and I have a file cabinet filled front to back with NDAs or non-disclosure agreements. So some stuff I sort of can't go into just because there's a privacy or an intellectual property issue. But in the general context of things, I think the most interesting thing is synthetic biology. This is really the big deal. It's around the corner. And in fact, I was going to go on coast to coast at one point and talk about this. I may still do some someday if they decide they want to do this. But the idea of being able to build an organism from scratch, literally. I mean, just, I'm not talking about genetically reengineering a microbe or taking a bit of a cell and sort of modifying. I'm talking about building something from scratch that, after a certain point, will begin to propagate, multiply, and have its own autonomous behavior. That line was crossed in December of 2005.
Exciting.
And you're going to see, well, here's where it goes. In terms, and you being a medical doctor, you might really appreciate this.
Not a medical doctor.
Okay, well, I'll correct that, but that was my interpretation. But my thought would be this. If you're looking at how people are treated for different pathologies and different things that happen to the human body, the usual procedure has been wait until a pathology occurs, then back annotate whatever the thing is, and then throw some drugs at it and hope it cures the problem or makes it less of a problem.
Not very practical.
It has a lot of problems. We're on the same page. So I think a much more interesting way to approach this would be to recognize the proclivities that are happening before they make any kind of damage and then preemptively prevent that from happening, and essentially make people healthy from the start, as opposed to fixing them after they get broken. So can a living system do this? And in certain contexts, yes. I think it's going to be certainly things like an artificial immune system or things like that that could been enhancements in human physiology that's one area, but the area that I'm most interested in personally is the ability to manufacture materials that would otherwise not be possible or be very difficult. Now, in the short term, getting back to medicine, there's a huge amount of troubles in the so-called developing world with a lot of these really strange and peculiar diseases, which are actually becoming much more manifest now, mainly because of climate change and population migration, that kind of thing. And yet the cost it takes to research and develop and actually deploy a new type of drug or some kind of regimen is unbelievably expensive. It's in the billions of dollars. And so for many reasons, a lot of these third world diseases, as they're called, are becoming rampant and really spreading around. It might be a whole different approach. If instead of having to go through the usual process and eventually chemically refine some new compound, what if you just grow the compound? And in fact, this is where it gets really interesting, because we have discovered over the years a really interesting range of plants, and in some cases animals, who produce these marvelous compounds. They occur in nature, but they're rare or they're difficult to get. What if you could just make a sort of a protocell that would simply replicate the compound in question on a mass scale, but at very low cost? This would have a huge effect on medicine and care of health in these developing parts of the world. I think it would help the world in general. And I think from that point onward, then this becomes a platform from which to create other things, including, by the way, organic computers.
And if this were grown totally in the laboratory, then we would not have the problem of worrying about crossover diseases from animals to humans.
And there's so much to be said for this. It's a really complex problem. And once again, not to get too political, but I think if you look at a lot of the areas of the world where you have crushing poverty, you know, horrible situations with lack of water and food and contamination and cholera, and just, you know, you could look at like Zimbabwe as an example. It's like a horrible nightmare. Well, these are the kinds of situations that breed terrorism. This is where you get political unrest. This is where people who are desperate and who are panicking, who are isolated, will flock to any sort of, no matter how crazy or bizarre it sounds, if somebody appears on the horizon that has a solution that makes their world somewhat different, they'll follow them through the gates of hell, as it were. And so that's where a lot of these bizarre religious fanatics or sort of, I don't know what you want to call them, messiahs or some new political concept, have their followings, and they wreak havoc to the rest of the world. So in a way, trying to solve these problems isn't just because it's a good thing to do, but it also actually helps the world in general and prevents these things from happening.
Oh, definitely, definitely. We need solutions.
Yes.
That's such a biggie, and it's there's no reason. There's just too much technology and too much ability, and the cost should not be where they are.
Yeah. Well, also the motivations, I think, could be different. And this is something I have in the past, and that people tend to think that in order to cross a certain threshold, it takes a huge, centralized, big government, big bureaucracy thing to sort of drive to the next square in the chessboard. I'm saying that's changing. It's changing very fast. And where I'm hoping this might go, certainly when you have the sort of nanotechnology, nanobiology sort of mixed together, is that now even small countries or even small consortia don't need these gigantic sort of lumbering behemoths of money and bureaucracy and political intrigue to get a solution that would actually help solve their localized problems. I think that's where things want to be going. We want to be seeing a much more granular, much more tightly connected to the actual communities in question, and have them have a stake in the ownership or the sort of policy aspects of how these problems are solved. And I think, a lot of the political difficulties or problems we've seen in the past have really come from these gigantic sort of foreign aid-driven, you know, programs where, you know, millions and millions of dollars worth of debt is thrust upon some country that they can't pay back, and so then they're forced to some kind of weird debt servitude, and they have to, you know, I mean, all that nonsense, that's all unnecessary. I mean, that's the stuff we want to get rid of. So can these technologies offer a different paradigm? I say yes.
Well, yeah, it definitely seems that this would lend itself to the downsizing and the availability on local levels for all these different areas.
And also just as needed. I think this is the other big area. Mm. If I was to, you know, have my 3 hours of stay in the Congress or something, I'd be looking very hard at, maybe, I don't say General Motors should die or something, but I mean, I think the General Motors model is outdated. I think what we want to be seeing is, again, a much more localized, granular, just as needed kind of a production process, that we don't have to commit billions of dollars to eat some huge resource just to get, you know, product out into the marketplace. Things can be made as needed and only as needed, and in fact, you could turn on a dime in terms of developing your next strategy, your next marketing ploy, whatever it is. That kind of stuff, I think, is where the promise could be in the future.
Well, that will be wonderful. That's we can discuss how we can make that happen.
Okay.
Well, people need to know where they have to focus and what they can do. I mean, so many people are without help. Well, you've been taking us on a time machine, Charles. I can't believe it's the bottom of the hour. So we will be back after some of these messages, and we will look forward to more of your fabulous information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Is waiting at the head of the stairs that lead up through your opened mind.
When looking at your personal preparedness level, remember the freeze-dry guy. During times of physical and emotional stress like the uncertain times we live in today, it is vital that you not alter your diet too much. You should only store what you usually eat, because one day you may have to eat only what you have stored. Lucky for you, there's the freeze-dry guy. Featuring the superior nutrition and taste you've come to expect, the freeze-dry guy has a wide variety of choices in freeze-dried foods. All freeze-dried foods are no-cook products requiring only hot water and a few minutes of your time. The freeze-dry guy has been serving various government agencies as well as the private sector with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. Consider the technological advances made in computers from the punch card days of the 60s and 70s to the high-speed personal computers of today. Comparably, the advances made in food storage from the World War II era till now are equally great. Visit the website at www.freezedryguy.com or call toll-free 866-404-3663.
Your area has just unexpectedly flooded. The power's out, so is the water, and you are thirsty. But wait, outside, look. There's lots of water. And then you see it.
Oh my gosh! What is that floating in the water? And what is that odor?
No problem. You thought ahead and own a Berkey water purification system. Berkey has revolutionized the way water is purified simply and naturally. Requiring no power, electricity, or water pressure, the powerful black Berkey elements extract pathogenic bacteria, cysts, parasites, chemicals, heavy metals, and yeah, other nasties that might be found in flood water. Berkey systems can purify treated water during normal times, and during unexpected emergencies, they can get rid of the unhealthy stuff and raw, untreated water.
For more information on the powerful Berkey line of products, go to themicroeffect.com and click on Berkey Water Filters. That's themicroeffect.com and click on Berkey Water Filters. Or dial 888-803-4438.
TheMicroEffectLive.com. Undistorted truth. Talk hosts that blow the horn on the Matrix world. Welcome to TheMicroEffectLive.com. Say goodbye to fake news. Say goodbye to fake radio. Welcome to TheMicroEffectLive.com. The intelligent source for news, updates, and of course, the truth.
One step into the light, one step away from night. It's the hardest step you're gonna take. The ship to take you there is waiting at the head of the stairs that lead up through your opened mind.
Hello, you are listening to the Rumor Mill News Radio Show, Into the Light. This is Dr. Robin Falcov, and our fascinating guest today is Charles Osman. Welcome back, Charles.
Thank you.
I'd like to go exploring with you.
Please, Robin.
I know we've had some previous discussions about the integration of consciousness and quantum quantum physics and so many different areas that converge in ways that people have not really thought about before. What can you share with us about outer space and consciousness?
Sure. Well, actually, people have thought about this for thousands of years, but they use a different set of terms. And I'll start in a kind of a basic way and then kind of lead towards where I was hoping to go. If you look upon all the major civilizations, almost every continent, Pacific Islanders, everything in between, you find this extremely consistent sort of like overlaying aspect of their spiritual mythos or their rituals or their various practices and so forth. And the general theme is that all living things are interconnected, that there's something beyond life that is confined by a human body, and that the planet around us is part of a larger living system. And when you look at all these different cultures, I don't care whether it's Asia, Africa, Central Europe, Eastern Europe, all over, you know, America, etc., you find almost the exact same recognition of these basic concepts. Even though the languaging and expression can be very different, the same core theme comes out every time. So statistically, one would have to assume that there's something more than just random thought. I mean, maybe there's something being observed here. And as it turns out, of course, if you look at many ancient practices, whether it's shamanism or different kinds of healers and different kinds of people who use their mental capacity to influence their surroundings, again, extremely consistent. I mean, there's certainly a certain amount of fluff that's been attached to it, but the core theme is there every time. So now you go, okay, is there something really to this? And if so, can it be measured? Can it be characterized? Can it be put together in some kind of a framework that the so-called hard sciences could actually have a look at this? Now, as it turns out, even here in the United States, of course, there were some military finance projects. We had the so-called remote viewing programs and so on. I've talked to all the usual suspects, the Danes and so forth. And then, of course, in the Soviet Union and even now in China, the much more militarized version of these things is being pursued to this very day, and that's a whole separate topic. But where I wanted to go with this is the following idea, that a lot of folks feel very strongly, myself included, that we're just about on the very edge. It's like approaching Las Vegas at night. You can see the glow of the city from 50 miles out, but you can't quite make out the signs. So we can kind of see now a framework for how this potential for what I might call empathic interaction, or like an empathic layer of sort of different kinds of processes go on. We can begin to describe mathematically and also from a physics perspective how this might actually work. And why is this relevant, and why does it do with outer space, you're thinking? That's a great question. So here goes the answer. A lot of people have talked about the speed of light as being the ultimate limitation. In other words, they've talked to the SETI folks and all the usual people in that context. They think in terms of how fast can a radio wave travel through space, or everything's connected to sort of linear time scale. And I'm saying, well, wait a second. Hold on. There may be a different way of looking at this. For many, many years, we were trained in our college and even high school text that, you know, the four-dimensional universe, you have three spatial and temporal dimensions, that's how it works, but I'm fine. Well, that's all changing. Now, of course, I mean, people are debating, is it 11 dimensions or 13, you know, et cetera. And in fact, the Hadron Collider in CERN is going to be the big deal that sort of opened this thing up. But many folks have now looked at and can, in fact, prove that there are more than four dimensions. I'll give you sort of a quick example. At the IBM Research Facility in Zurich, going back to the mid-90s, the first ever experiment was shown where photons could be, I'll make it simpler, they could cut the photons in half and send them down opposite ends of a very long fiber optic cable. And if one part of the photon was rotated or moved, the other half would move along with it, even though they're separated by many kilometers of fiber optic space. So this kind of proved, rather specifically, that things do connect together in some kind of a fabric that goes beyond four dimensions. Well, if you talk to Stephen Hawking or Michio Kaku or any of the sort of, you know, top thinkers today, they will go into great detail talking about, yes, there's multiple dimensions of time as well as space, kind of suggest that there's something going on here. Okay, fine. Now, if we can kind of show on the ground that something separated by space can actually basically, there's a leakage going on, okay, where does that go from there? Well, as it turns out, in the world of encryption, going back to that one more time, there's companies now who will actually sell encryption systems where, again, because of this quantum linkages of photonics or groups of photons, they can embed encryption codes in these quantum interconnected signals. And that's actually being used now. You can actually buy this. This is something you can actually, various military agencies and defense related organizations actually use this in today's sort of battlefield. So this is no longer fluff. This is hard science. It's actually commercial product. So where does it go from there? Well, here's where it goes. If we can show that things are coupled, in a way that goes beyond that four-dimensional limitation. What happens in space? What happens when somebody from who knows where, could be light years away, may in fact be using a completely different kind of mechanism to transfer thought, to transfer consciousness, and to communicate, and perhaps even travel? I think the door is being blown wide open. And in fact, there's a kind of a rift going on, because you have two different camps, actually. And I have a group of friends at NASA that I talk with, you know, sort of privately, and we all have these interesting debates. But there's just a big shift going on that says, you know, the traditional model of here we are on Earth is this sort of isolated civilization, and the closest life forms maybe 50 light years away, and they would never get here because they have these rockets to fly around. Now, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. I'm sorry, that's just my opinion. I think a very different way of looking at this is there's a different kind of set of rules that determines how many different dimensions or how many parallel dimension sets we may be getting access to. And if we open that Pandora's box up, it will not only completely change how we look at our surrounding cosmos, star systems, other civilizations, it will also completely change how we relate to each other. Because at that point, one's thoughts, one's intent, as it were, even their subconscious intent, will in fact drive the reality around them. And this is something that the ancient civilizations had pretty much figured out. They didn't have the science of it exactly, but the sense is that they could see what they could observe. And this is where I find this kind of fascinating. In fact, there was a great film called Forbidden Planet that came out back in the late 50s. And it kind of signified this idea about there was this mythical civilization called the Krell, and they had, you know, developed this beautiful technology where their thoughts could be instantaneously materialized into whatever they could dream up. And so they put this thing online thinking that everybody would just be beautiful and be happy and nobody would have any greed or avarice and they could solve all their social problems. And the thing they forgot about was the, you know, ultimate punchline, you know, monsters of the id. That is, they did not think about their subconscious that might become manifest in these terrible things. And, of course, it did, and they killed each other off in a single night. Well, we're sort of at that point now, kind of. In other words, if you look at some of the latest research, people like Stuart Hammer at the University of Arizona, there's a lot of work being done in Europe. Dean Radin, of course, somebody I have great respect for, I've talked to him many times. And these folks are serious medical doctors and physicists who are now looking at sort of the nanoscale quantum interactivity of different kinds of cellular systems. We're discovering that neurons, when they fire, actually emit light. We're discovering that there's a biophotonic system that goes beyond the sodium ion exchange process for information that's transferred to the brain. We know that we can conduct experiments now where you can take different kinds of organisms and separate them by, you know, great distances, and yet they will interact with each other that we can't explain why. I mean, this has all been done. This has been shown in a lab. So what does it really mean? Well, I think within the next 10, 15 years, we're going to step into a new territory where the folks that sort of know this stuff are going to apply it in whatever way they think might be interesting. Could it be weaponized? Yes. And it could be horrible. It could be an unbelievable nightmare. But at the same time, could it completely change our behaviors, our perception, and our sense of this world? Absolutely. And would that be the next step towards allowing us the privilege of access to be more spiritually mature, and use that word kind of delicately here, so that we could, in fact, connect to the surrounding cosmos in a way that's not predatory? I think those are all the things that we're going to be looking at in the near future.
No, I think that will be wonderful. I mean, the first step is for people on this planet to realize that we all share this planet. And,
yeah. You
know, what affects one is going to affect another.
And if we can't learn that, if we don't get past this next sort of square on the chessboard, then all bets are off. And I, you know, I'm not necessarily a 2012 fanatic, but I do think that there is something coming around the corner. I don't know if it's going to be 2012, but as you know, I gave a brief talk about this at the 2012 conference at Joshua Tree a couple years ago. And a lot of folks are looking at this very carefully now. I mean, whether it's the Upanishads or the Mayan calendar, or, you know, there's all range of things you can look at, the Vedic principles and so on. They all kind of point to something happening around the first third of what's now called the 21st century. And what would be that reason for it? And here's my sort of two cents worth that I just throw it out there. I tend to think that life is very mundane, very rote. Nothing special about us. We're humanoids, and here we are on our little planet, but there's billions of planets out there, so what? Okay, fine. So if that's the case, then it would be reasonable to assume that there's going to be a basic model that one can follow. It says a planet of a given size with a given population type of X, with a certain amount of land mass, a certain amount of resources, it'll take them a certain level of integration and development to the point where they suddenly hit this burst called the singularity, where all of a sudden everything's interconnected and industry's taken off and you have skyrocketing populations. I mean, these are all predictable things. And I would guess, I'm just throwing it out there, I would guess, this has been repeated many times over, endless times over. It's become a very standardized kind of like a roadmap for these processes to occur. So through some kind of process or some kind of mechanism, who knows, we were told by somebody from somewhere that says, look, we know your planet type, we know your population type, we see what's coming around the corner. You're going to have this much time to kind of figure it out and be better humanoids, not kill each other, not do horrible things. And if you can figure this out by date X, then you'll probably be allowed to progress to the next square. If you don't, you'll probably wipe yourselves out in the planet and reset and start all over. And then I was told about it. I think somebody or some groups of somebody's said, you know, we know how this works, and here's the basic measures. Now you figure it out, and we'll come back in a while and have a look. I think we're approaching that end point right now.
Well, that makes perfect sense, because we certainly have found evidence of much more ancient civilizations.
Oh, yes. I have not even the slightest doubt. And it's kind of funny, because I came at this a few years ago with no interest at all. I was really a very mundane sort of hard science type. And I started reading some books, and I saw some early writings by Sitchin and some others. I said, you know, that's kind of interesting. I haven't seen this before. And then it turns out some friends of mine who actually are in the archaeology world, they would tell me things. They'd say, hey, look, we're digging stuff up that nobody can explain, and they won't let us talk about it. And I said, wait. You know, I mean, there's stuff hidden in museum back rooms. It's mind-boggling. And it's kind of sad, because in the world of science, every science has its sort of level of politics and competitiveness, and people are, you know, fighting over grants, and there's all kinds of weird overtones. But probably nowhere is it worse than the sort of mix between history and anthropology, because you get so many weird nationalistic and cultural and just, you know, strange leanings that just sort of flavor everything to suit a certain kind of agenda. I mean, a real scientist, theoretically, should go out, have a theory or have a thesis of some kind, set up an experiment, collect data, match those, observe the data, see if it matches or doesn't match, but whatever the data is, use the data as the way to drive the next theory, as opposed to going out with a preset conclusion and trying to force the data to fit the conclusion.
Oh, my God.
And in anthropology, that's what it's really, I'm sorry to say, I do not want to insult any anthropologists. My heart goes with them. But for the folks that have done this kind of work has experience, they'll probably tell you privately, oh, yeah, we dug up stuff that we can't possibly explain what this is. But, you know, here it is in a box hidden away itself in the back room of the university. So, I mean, you look at that kind of thing, okay, well, what else could be happening? And I'll go a bit further on the limb. I would suggest to you that here on this planet, every time we've seen a civilization come from one continent to the next, not every time, but certainly the majority of times, usually it has catastrophic results. The so-called discovering, whatever you want to call it, will land on the shore of some new continent somewhere. And usually there'll be wars and things will happen, and they'll wipe out the indigenous population and crush it so they can take advantage. You know, that's sort of the usual thing. We have a pretty bad history for that kind of stuff. Okay, fine. So if we're to be allowed to sort of live in a larger universe, as it were, we have to show by evidence of our own behavior that we're capable of doing this, that we have a different kind of way of looking at our surroundings. And we have to go through a series of trial and error, like trauma-induced evolutionary steps, as it were, to determine if we're able to do this in a way that's non-predatory, in a much more interactive way that's mutually supportive and so forth. And we have to kind of demonstrate on our own before we're going to be allowed the chance to sort of go somewhere else. So in a way, it's completely reasonable that we'd be sort of stuck here in this planet for a while, and we have to show by our own means that we're capable of coming to that point that you just described, where we recognize that we're all part of the same planet, and we all see the same sort of potential for our life and where we go. And if we cross that line and haven't killed ourselves with the technology in question, then we sort of are allowed the chance to sort of go beyond. But I think it has to be that way. I think it's a requirement, like raising a child in a way. You have to sort of let the child learn certain lessons and see if they mature to the next stage.
Well, and there's a very important little phrase that you used, what if. We have to start exploring the what if, because where science, medicine, all areas of thought and research go is that, okay, that's not possible, this is impossible. If we look at that, then nothing will ever happen.
Yes, right.
We have to recognize that we have limited information, and we have to consider that it's always mutable.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
it's these
things. And in fact, the best scientists that you'll ever have a chance to talk to, I spent a few months in Michigan, actually, a year ago just for fun. I mean, the best people will tell you, we don't know all the answers. In fact, every time we learn something, we discover 10 things we didn't know, and that's the whole point. That's what science is supposed to be for. And that's why I get very nervous and kind of unhappy when I see these really rigid, sort of dogma-like and like, here's the box. It must fit into the box. If you take up this artifact, it has to match this particular box. You know, stop. This is nonsense. This is not where we want to be going. We have to really reverse these trends. Now, sorry to say, a lot of this has to do with kind of traditional religions, and I'm, you know, not to get into an ancient religion. I mean, I'm very spiritual myself, but I think that somewhere down the trail, we got kind of badly misled in the sense that having faith in a supreme being or having faith in the spiritual aspects of life beyond what we see here, and that's all lovely. I completely support that. But to turn that into a kind of a rigid, blind faith dogma that says our version of the book of something is better than your version and we must kill you because you don't read our book, this is stupid. This is completely ridiculous. This is the absolute worst example of how these like spiritual messages could be interpreted. So we have to learn how to get beyond that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's still a coin flip. I'm not sure we're going to get beyond that point, but I mean, people are trying. But that's the real challenge as I see it.
Well, and then where is common sense? There are so many different religions on this planet. How can any one religion claim to be the religion with the right answers?
Right. And what I've discovered, of course, is interesting to me. I've discovered that especially, I mean, I lived just a few blocks from the UC campus. I've been here for 30 plus years. And a lot of the kids I run into, these, you know, folks in their early 20s, late teens, very smart, and they're very interesting. A lot of them do actually come from very specific religious backgrounds, but they're not crazy about it. They see the value of the culture, they understand the traditions and so forth, but if you talk to them about life from other worlds or a larger universe, they're like, yeah, of course, we get it. I mean, no problem. I think what's really happened is you have the older generation who really can't adapt to this new idea. It's too far out for them. And in a weird kind of way, if you recall, I think it was the Rand Corporation that did this report back in the late 50s about, you know, if the U.S. population found out about aliens, they would go crazy and they'd be rising in the street. They may have been right back at that time, because if you go backwards in that point, most people really were tied to a different kind of religious-based protocol. Everything that they saw in the world had to be fed to the mandrel of a sort of biblical interpretation or something. Most young people today, even if they are very religious, they don't have that same kind of blind, unthinking sort of automaton reaction to these religious systems. They are actually looking for a broader way of interpreting their spiritual place in a larger universe. So it may just be a generational thing. That's what I'm hoping for. But going back to something I said at the last half-hour segment, where you have isolation and hunger and desperate situations and political extremism, that's where you have the religious entities of the question at the moment use the religion as a kind of a platform to drive people to craziness that they wouldn't ordinarily accept. And that's kind of the pathology I see.
Yes, definitely. To drive them to craziness or just to control them to
accept control their craziness and use the craziness. I've often talked about, in some of my lectures, I talk about chaos as a commodity. I mean, it is. If you can engineer chaos, deliver it in some kind of controllable fashion to implement some kind of change or usurpation of an economy or some kind of like a battlefield tactic, as it were, through the population. It's exactly how it's used. And religion is the number one tool to instigate people to do crazy things and commit horrible crimes to other people under the guise of the so-called religious title of facts, whatever it might be, fill in the blank.
Yes. We're on the same page about that.
And if we can solve this craziness, there was a great, Bill Maher produced this film called Religiosity, which I thought was a pretty good film. It sort of captured this idea. Again, I'm not in any way trying to discourage people from having their faith or saying that they're wrong for the faith that they were brought of it or have chosen to belong to. That's not where I'm going with this. But where I am going with this is to have this blind, unthinking, automaton-like, like a zombie-like submission to this so-called dogma that comes out of a book somewhere, that's where it gets very bad in a very short amount of time. And usually the people who are least able to think for themselves are the ones who are taken advantage of and used as these instruments of chaos.
Yes, definitely. You would think the lesson would be learned because it's happened over and over and over in so many different areas of science. You were bringing up how many dimensions. Now, we know there are more than four. Wouldn't people finally realize that to put a limit and say, well, there are 11, what they should recognize is they haven't identified what's out there?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. That's 100% right. And, you know, I just threw out the number 11 because it happened to be the popular number.
Yes.
The moment. Some people are talking 13. I mean, but there's no number. That's what's mathematically recognized at the point. But that's why, for instance, the Hadron Collider is a big deal because, in a way, it allows the sort of physicists of that ilk of interest to really begin to open the box of what happens at the femtoscale and beyond level of interaction. In other words, even at the nanoscale, we're seeing quantum activity we never could have predicted before, and I throw it out there just for fun. When I was at Lawrence Laboratory here at UC Berkeley, I was working with Charles Mandel in my background. So, I mean, we would play with different kinds of metals and ceramics and looking for superconductivity in certain materials and that kind of stuff. But as we began to examine down to the scale of atoms or molecules, we noticed behaviors that were just really weird, and we didn't understand this. And we had always assumed, or was taught in my textbooks, that the rules of physics would apply at all scales. But then we started doing experiments and said, well, wait a minute, that's not what the data is telling us. I really admit we had no idea what was going on, but we discovered interesting things. So, I mean, here we are now looking at the biology side of things at the same scale, looking at the actual atoms and molecules as they interact in these sort of quantum interconnected ways that we could not describe in previous times, but now we can actually see this happening. So we can begin now to look at the math and say, does the mathematical model of these multidimensional systems match the data? And actually, it does. So this is so interesting. And the more we learn, the more we know we don't know. But that's the whole point, to have that level of openness and be able to pursue where the research leads, as opposed to having a predetermined outcome. I think this is where the science could be going, because in a sense, we now have an international, sort of a global approach to solving big problems. And at a certain point of emergency, people begin to realize, look, I don't care if it's politically correct or not. I just want a solution. I got to solve this problem. So how do we do this? And so in a way, once again, trauma is kind of driving an evolutionary process that may not have occurred previously, but I think it's occurring now under duress. But that may be a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good point, definitely. People just have to get past the need to set limits that, you know, this is where it stops, this is where it ends, and just be part of the process to explore.
Well, one thing I will talk about, and I know this has been discussed before, but I'll throw it out from my perspective. I think the next big thing that's going to happen outside of synthetic biology, which is sort of my favorite idea and topic, is in the commercialization of space. And we're kind of in a bad spot right now because, I mean, for a lot of reasons. I mean, we're bankrupt. We owe our trillions of dollars to China and Saudi Arabia, which is absurd. And our space shuttle goes offline a couple of years, and we're just, you know, the whole thing's just like falling apart. Meanwhile, around the other side of the planet, you've got Russia, China, and India with a newly formed space alliance. They're very formal about it. And they are going to, in a sense, become the new entity to deliver packages to orbit and beyond orbit. At a fairly low cost. I mean, you've got India with their electronics industry very much geared to go with this. You've got China, who's quite capable of building technology and putting it in mass scale. You have Russia with a lot of their space experience ready to sort of settle to the highest bidder. They are. They're selling to the Chinese. I mean, the point is, we've really shot ourselves in the foot by not being more persistent and consistent with having an agenda that says, space is really where we need to be aiming at, not just to discover new planets, but to actually use it in a productive way, whether you're having orbiting systems for piping energy back down to the planet or for fabrication of materials. There's a lot of medical materials, by the way, which can be made in low orbit. I mean, there's a lot of things that can be done in space that we sort of just didn't seem to. It was a bad marketing. We couldn't get the public to see the value, but other countries are seeing the value. Believe me, they are. And if we lose our edge at that next sort of stage in the world economy, we're going to be left far behind. And I just throw it out there as a sort of a momentary thought.
Oh, well, it's very important. I mean, people need to realize we wouldn't have cell phones. We wouldn't have so much medical technology.
We wouldn't have our desktop computers. We wouldn't have our laptops.
Yeah.
All the stuff that you see around it, all your iPods and all the fancy flat TVs, we wouldn't exist at all. That all came out of space program.
Yes. Good reason for people to support that research, and I'm hoping we have a better environment now with this administration.
I think we do, I didn't want to be too political, but I give Obama a lot of credit for at least trying to do something different. What we had in the past 8 years was a very secretive, very unopen, very non-transparent sort of way of doing things, and, strangely enough, a very anti-science kind of approach to the world.
Yes.
I can tell you from personal experience, a lot of my academic friends here at Berkeley and Stanford and elsewhere, whether they were doing medical research or researching certain aspects of life in other worlds or astronomy in general, or even looking at things like climate change or the subtleties of different kinds of climatic situations, their research, their grants were being heavily garnered and edited. And in many cases, people had to change their own personal viewpoint, the grant potential of the moment, or to keep their tenureship or the department thing going. this was craziness. It was like a moratorium on thought. So, I mean, please, at least allow the scientists to do the research where it's interesting.
Definitely, definitely. Charles, you just have way too much to share. Can we get you back?
Well, I'll always come back anytime, yes. Sure.
Thank you. And is your best website historianofthefuture.com?
That's the website. It's a little bit out of date, but I am putting new stuff up there, and anyone's welcome to go and check it out.
Well, that's super. And they can contact you through your website?
Absolutely.
Perfect. We have an article up on Rumor Mill News about you. And I thank you so much for being with us. And I'm checking the calendar, and I want to see what day will work for you next week.
Okay, well, we'll go from there and take have a great day, and we'll talk soon.
Thank you, Charles.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, this is Dr. Robin Falca for Rumor Mill News Radio Show, Into the Light. Thank you for joining us. And be sure to check back, because you never know what exciting news we'll be sharing with you next.
When looking at your personal preparedness level, remember the freeze-dry guy. During times of physical and emotional stress like the uncertain times we live in today, it is vital that you not alter your diet too much. You should only store what you usually eat, because one day you may have to eat only what you have stored. Lucky for you, there's the freeze-dry guy. Featuring the superior nutrition and taste you've come to expect, the freeze-dry guy has a wide variety of choices in freeze-dried foods. All freeze-dried foods are no-cook products, requiring only hot water and a few minutes of your time. The freeze-dry guy has been serving various government agencies as well as the private sector with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. Consider the technological advances made in computers from the punch card days of the 60s and 70s to the high-speed personal computers of today. Comparably, the advances made in food storage from the World War II era till now are equally great. Visit the website at www.freezedryguy.com or call toll-free 866-404-3663.
Gordon Liddy here. For the same reason you'd own a firearm to protect yourself and your family, you own gold to protect your financial future. For safety, security, and liquidity, you should, as I do, turn at least a small percentage of your portfolio into gold. The advisors at Rosland Capital are financial gurus from some of America's largest and most famous financial institutions. They do not have short-term sales goals. Instead, their objective is to help you meet your long-term financial goals. The service is free, utterly confidential, and they're waiting for your call. Grab a pen. As with a firearm, because you don't know when you'll need it, I believe you should have it now. Rosland Capital. R-O-S-L-A-N-D. RoslandCapital.com. Write this number down and use it today. 1-800-685-0560. 1-800-685-0560.
To look younger and feel youthful and revitalized. We strive for these things our whole life, but always seem to fall short of our expectations. Some products on the market may sound great, but all you're really getting is expensive marketing and a bottle full of chemicals. Remember, aging is a disease, reminding us every day that our bodies are breaking down. The new wave of natural health and beauty is here with Orgon's G5 Organic Silica. The anti-aging potential of G5 Organic Silica is one of the elements in the body that becomes greatly deficient as we age. Just 2 tablespoons of G5 Organic Silica a day can help keep aging away. Also, check out Orgon's Chembuster. With a food shortage and crops more precious than ever, the Chembuster can help alleviate drought and increase fertility and vitality of your crops. Health does not need to be expensive or complicated. Simple technology equals profound results at OrgonProducts.org. Visit orgoneproducts.org or call 646-498-5309. That's 646-498-5309.